I was given a copy of the journal, the latest edition here, big two-page article in it. The Passover day was moved 24 hours earlier by Herbert Armstrong. Then he goes on to say, ministers can't move Passover, which is interesting because he just said he did. This is not a new thing amongst our genre. I've heard of this a long time ago, and it kind of illustrates that contingent in our fellowship that believes that the original Passover in Egypt was toward the end of the 14th into the 15th, which is a common tradition among Jewish and Messianic types even today. But I just wonder how Herbert Armstrong projected his authority back to the Ephraimite Samaritans a century ago, or how he persuaded Christ and his disciples to keep it at a different time. Did they know something that people today don't know? I'm going to talk about that a little bit. This is an appropriate subject, I think, to this season of the year. It probably wouldn't be appropriate any other time, but since we are just concluding this season, I think it would be good for us to go back and review the information that we have in the Old Testament concerning these holy days, particularly the Passover and then what we call the night to be much observed. And I usually forget to mention this, so let me do it right up front. But there are copies of my outline. You might be tempted to take notes. You're going to realize shortly into this that that's going to be futile. There is so much information and so many resources here. So I have at least a dozen of these floating around. There's some on the side table there where all of these notes, you won't need to write the dates down or the scriptural references. You can have this outline. And if anyone online would like one, I can email it to you. So we're going to walk through the scriptures and look and see what happens and understand the original chronology as it's given to us. There are many points of information that have been embraced in the world of religion, particularly the Christian Jewish religions, that are not correct. There's things we ought to know because we have the Bible that tells us. I want to give us a more complete perspective on what the scriptures tell us. One thing we know is this progression of holy days, this season of the year, was planned well in advance. This was not something dreamed up in the time of Moses. In fact, it begins way back in Genesis chapter 15. It's that event that we call the Abrahamic covenant. Because in the covenant, or in that sacrifice that was presented at that time in accordance with God's instruction, Abraham and his descendants were introduced to something that would happen more than four centuries into the future. Genesis 15, chapter 15, verse 13. He said unto Abraham, know of a surety that your seed shall be a stranger in a land that is not theirs. Keep that thought in mind. Strangers in a land that is not theirs, and they shall serve them and shall afflict them 400 years. And also that nation whom they shall serve I will judge, and afterward shall they come out with great substance. This is a prophecy of something in the future. This is a prophecy that they were going to spoil the Egyptians and they were going to gain their release from the bondage that they were in. Clear back in the time of Abraham. Now, Abraham was probably in his 70s about this time. Abraham was born just a couple of years after Noah died. This goes back that far in history. in this sacrifice that God instructed Abraham to set up, we can read of it in about verse 9, Genesis 15, verse 9. And he said to him, take me an heifer of 3 years old, and a she-goat of 3 years old, and a ram of 3 years old, animals in their reproductive prime, and a turtle dove and a young pigeon. Now, at other times I've spoken on that particular passage and showed that those four items of sacrifice represent the four successive ages of the covenant that God was working out with his redeemed. The heifer represented the patriarchal period. The she-goat represented the old covenant system. The ram of 3 years old represents the Christian era. And then the turtle dove and the young pigeon represents the millennial age. I won't take time to go into that any further, but it's just something to be aware of. The sacrificial system, or the covenant made to Abraham, carries on even to the present day. And the Apostle Paul shows that in Colossians 2:17. There is a connection between us and that event. Let's just look quickly in Colossians because it's an important cornerstone for this particular subject. Colossians 2, verse 17. No, I've got the wrong reference. It's the one that says, if you be Christ, you are Abraham's seed and heirs according to the promise.
Galatians 3:29.
Anyway, that's the verse that I want to refer to. That shows that that covenant made to Abraham is still ongoing, and it has relevance to people today under the new covenant. But God prophesied to Abraham that they would, what we call, sojourn in a land that wasn't theirs, for some 400, and this is round figures at the time, some 400 years. What does it mean to sojourn? It's important that we understand that. Sojourn means to temporarily reside somewhere. In a sense, we sojourn at the feast each year. We go to some place that isn't ours. Different circumstances, I realize, but it illustrates the meaning of the term. Sojourn means to be a guest in another person's territory, not one's own. But there's another essence in the meaning of the term, and that is to wait until they arrive at or till they achieve some destiny or destination. The sojourning was from a point in time to another point in time. There was a gap between the promise that was given to them and its receipt. Now, how long was that? Well, in Exodus 12:40, we're told, and this is a verse that trips people up, but Exodus 12:40, it says, now the sojourning of the children of Israel who dwelt in Egypt was 430 years. Well, that was from when to when? I was emailing a fellow that has a website, and I didn't realize, but there's people who believe that the sojourning was from the time that the children of Israel went into Egypt and the time that they left. There's a problem with that, but we'll come to that. There's others who think it was from the time of the Abrahamic covenant to the giving of the law, but the giving of the law was 1 year later than the Exodus. I'm of the opinion, and I think it's correct, that the sojourning was from the time that the Abrahamic covenant was given to the Exodus. And the verse that sort of illustrates that is earlier, where it says, they left Egypt on the self-same day. Now, some people interpret that to mean that two events happened on the same day. In other words, the Passover and the Exodus occurred within the same nighttime. That's one interpretation of the term the self-same day. The self-same day is a rather rare expression in the Old Testament. It's only used 11 times, whereas virtually 100 or more times it's translated something else. But the sense of the self-same day is to suggest an anniversary. In other words, they came out of Egypt on the anniversary of the Abrahamic covenant, that being exactly 430 years. Now that leaves us with a problem, because they didn't go into Egypt at the time of the Abrahamic covenant. Obviously, they weren't even born yet. You still had to go through the families of Isaac and Jacob before they even were a family that could go into Egypt. So there's a problem there. We should be able to see that problem. And I'll come to that in a few minutes. But it's important that we understand that the sojourning was 430 years. But they were not in Egypt for 430 years. And that's a mistake that is commonly held in the world of religion. The Israelites went into Egypt in about the third year of the famine. That's something to keep in mind. And that shows us that the famine extended over a much wider area than just geographical Egypt. They were not in Egypt for 430 years, nor were they in servitude during the entire time they were in Egypt. They were in servitude only a part of that. Now keep in mind, Joseph lived for 110 years. He was 17 when he was sold into slavery. And here's where I guess we can begin the pictures, Mark. He was 17. The first 17 years of his life was when he was with his family. Then his brothers sold him into slavery into Egypt. He spent the next 93 years of his life in Egypt. And he was well favored in Egypt. Joseph was in prison from about age 23, and that's a guesstimate on my part, until about age 30. And that the date, the age 30, we have a pretty good confirmation on. In other words, he was in prison for some 7 years before Pharaoh heard of him. And even his time in prison wasn't entirely a bad experience. It may have been at first. But Joseph's talents became recognized. And before long, Joseph was assisting the wardens who ran the prison. He had gained quite a reputation as being a competent individual. But Pharaoh finally learned of him as the results of his dream, and we know that story. So Joseph was elevated to a position of high authority in the Egyptian government at about age 30. And then there were the 7 years of plenty. And then about the third year of the famine is when Jacob and his family decided that they needed to relocate into Egypt. So they came into Egypt when Joseph was about 40. The oppression did not occur during Joseph's lifetime. We know that from Scripture. It was only after a Pharaoh who knew not Joseph imposed the oppression on the people. So there were 93 years in Egypt when Joseph was still alive before he died. So it was sometime after that, probably one generation after that, when they began to oppress them. Prior to that, the children of Israel were very well received in the nation. And in, I suppose with the general population, they still were. It was the political structure in Egypt that became concerned, because the nation was growing to such a degree that it became a military threat. But at first, they imposed hardships upon them and made them serve as basically as slaves. But that had to be a generation after Joseph died, which was about 1636 B.C., and a reference to that is Exodus 1:15. I won't take the time to go to all of these. So I said, Joseph lived 110 years, 93 of those years in Egypt. He was 17 when he was sold into slavery by his brothers, and reference to that is Genesis 37, verse 2. Joseph was 40 years old, and that is from his age of 30 when he was elevated to be vizier of the Pharaoh of Egypt, in which that was a very high authority in the kingdom, second only to Pharaoh himself. And he was basically making decisions subject to Pharaoh's approval, but he was basically running a whole segment of the economy. But he was about 10 years into Joseph's reign that his family joined him in Egypt. So we have a date. Joseph was about 40 years old when his father Jacob came there, and that was about 1706 B.C., and that's much later than conventional chronology has it. Joseph died about 1636 B.C., and here we might go to the next couple of pictures. There are excavations ongoing in the region, and they've pretty much identified where the Israelites lived. This, they believe, from the ruins, from the foundations that are still there, this is a picture of Joseph's palace. Being in a high position of authority that he had, that would be, it would be appropriate that he would certainly have a palace. Next picture. In the ruins of this palace, you notice in the backyard there was some structures. There were tombs back there. They found an empty tomb, and there was this statue that was all smashed to bits. Like the people didn't like the fellow. They put it back together and reconstructed it as best they can. They believe that's what Joseph looked like. And that's not a hairdo, that's sort of a headpiece that they wore. But that's what they expect Joseph looked like. Moses was born 65 years after Joseph died. And Moses was about 80 years old at the time of the Exodus. And we know that from Josephus, book 2, chapter 15, paragraphs 1 and 2. Moses very likely was born during the reign of Khnephra, also known as Sobekhotep IV. That would be the next picture. I'm sorry, that is a photo of, before we go on, that's a photo of the excavated tomb in the vicinity in the back area of Joseph's palace. Next picture. This is Khnephra. Pardon his complexion, but granite doesn't photograph very well. Usually they're sandstone, but this is a particularly hard rock to carve out of. But that was Khnephra, and that's very likely the pharaoh that was in power when Moses was born. The beginning of the reign of Khnephra to the beginning of Dudamos was about 82 years. Now, if that's the case, if this is the correct pharaoh for Moses' birth, then Dudamos would have been the pharaoh of the Exodus. And they don't have any statue of him that we know of. But it was about 82 years, which would have corresponded with the time that Moses came back into Egypt to petition to get the Israelites released. And at this point, we might say, Houston, we have a problem. As you can recall, the phrase made popular by the crew of Apollo 13, we have a problem. Because from these facts, we know something here. Joseph was 110 when he died. His father and his family came into Egypt when he was 40. So that's 80 years. From the time that Jacob came into Israel to the time that Joseph died was 80 years. Moses was born 65 years after Joseph died. And we know that Moses was 80 years old at the time of the Exodus. You add those together and you get 215 years, not 430. How do we reconcile that with the 430 years? Well, some texts, and we get the impression of the 430 years being the time they were in Egypt, comes from Exodus 12, verse 40. We were just there. Now the sojourning of the children of Israel who dwelt in Egypt was 430 years. However, that's not a complete verse. Some texts have not just in Egypt, but it says in Canaan and in Egypt. In other words, their sojourn spanned two periods of time. That period of time before they went into Egypt, and the period of time that they were in Egypt. You add those two together and you'll have 430 years. The Samaritan Pentateuch and the Septuagint, which is the Greek Old Testament translated in Egypt, the Samaritan Pentateuch and the Septuagint retains the full version where it says in Canaan and in Egypt. It's important to understand. My Nelson King James Version has it as a footnote that the 430 years includes the time in Canaan, which would carry from the time of the Abrahamic covenant to the Exodus. Now, Josephus confirms that where he says, 430 years was after Abraham and 215 years after Jacob. And that's in Antiquities, Book 2, Chapter 15, Paragraph 2. The oppression came along later, as we saw. It came along during the reign of a pharaoh who didn't know Joseph. Now, Joseph was a very popular man. So for a pharaoh to come along who didn't know Joseph would suggest that he lived in a different area and certainly in a different generation where Joseph's memory had faded. He might have known his name, but he didn't really know him as a person or know his reputation. But the oppression came in about, rough figures, about 100 years before the Exodus. Now, killing of the male babies is another thing. Exodus 1:11 and 1:15 gives us a little information about that. And from these, we can see that the two were not concurrent. Exodus 1:11, and this is that Pharaoh who didn't know Joseph. Therefore, they did set them over the taskmasters to afflict them with their burdens, and they built for Pharaoh treasure cities, Pitom, which is to the south of where they were, and Ramesses, which is the later name of the actual city in which they were located. And both of those are on the eastern side of the Nile Delta. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew, and they were grieved because of the children of Israel. So we can see that the idea of killing the firstborn, killing the baby males, didn't occur originally. That came later. Drop down to verse 15. And the king of Egypt spake to the Hebrew midwives, of which the name of one was Shiphrah and the name of the other was Puah. And they said, when you do the office of a midwife to them, to the Hebrew women, and see them upon the stools, if it be a son, then you shall kill him. But if it be a daughter, then she shall live. So the idea of killing the firstborn babies didn't occur originally. That came along a little later. How long it was carried on, we don't know. Probably not very long. But it's interesting that there's a parallel between the birth of Moses, a type of Christ, and Christ himself. Because a similar thing happened about the time of the birth of Christ. But I just want to make the point. The oppression lasted perhaps a century. The killing of the male infants, male newborns, was perhaps only done briefly. Next question is, how big was Israel? Believe it or not, we have two, possibly three different methods by which we can calculate the size of the children of Israel. I won't take the time to do that, but all of that is spelled out in chapter 2 of this booklet if you've read it. And I brought in every copy I had, so there's just a few more over there if anyone would like to read that. But it's fairly certain that the population of the children of Israel by the time of the Exodus was in excess of 2.5 to 3.5 million people. Let's take a conservative value and say about 3 million. And there are many sources that give that particular number. Could 70 people at the time that Jacob came into Egypt grow to be 3 million in that 215 years? Is it possible for population growth like that? Well, there's a formula by which it shows it's very possible. One of those methods is given in 1 Chronicles chapter 7, verses 22 to 27, which shows that there were roughly 10 to 10.5 generations between the time that Jacob came into Egypt and the time of the Exodus. Now, these were of Joseph's family, and Joseph was the second youngest in the family, so the older members certainly might have had more generational time than just that. Another method is found in Exodus 12:37, where they had 600,000 men of military capability at the time of the Exodus. 600,000. How big of a population would you need to be able to number 600,000 able-bodied, capable of war men in a generation? Those of military age, the males of military age from 20 years and upward, as it says, would typically be only about a quarter of the population. If you exclude the males under 20, and if you exclude the extreme elderly, it would be about a quarter of the population. So there's 2.5 million right there. Not counting the mixed multitude that went with them, not counting their herds and flocks, which the Bible says were massive, and I'll show you that they were massive in just a minute. And it also doesn't include, it didn't number the tribe of Levi. Now there's another passage where a census was taken later on towards the end of the Exodus that shows that the population remained constant. So that tells us something. Now, if you take the number of people in that left Egypt, and we know that they all died in the 40 years wandering in the wilderness, for that number of people to have died out by the time that they entered the Promised Land, they had to have had 500 and more deaths per day. You understand how big 3 million people are. Correspondingly, there would have been a similar number of births per day in order for the population to remain constant. And perhaps even more, because there were some major population losses in, for example, the breakaway attempt when they tried to return to Egypt that we read of in Numbers 14. The Korah situation that we read of in Numbers 16, the fiery serpent incident in Numbers 21, and the battle with Amalek in Exodus 17. Who was the Pharaoh of the Exodus? If you ask most people that question, they're going to pop out, well, it was Ramesses, obviously. Everybody knows that. Problem is, Ramesses, and the particular individual is Ramesses II, was in the wrong dynasty. He reigned from about 1279 to 1213 BC, 277 years too late. He reigned for 66 years, one of the longer reigning pharaohs, which is why we have so much monumental evidence of him, and he was certainly popular and powerful. But he was more than a quarter century too late. Ramesses was not the Pharaoh of the Exodus. That is a myth. And most people don't know that there were two Ramesses in the 19th dynasty, the first and the second. But there was another 9 Ramesses in the 20th dynasty. Let's keep in mind, the Bible doesn't anywhere name any of the pharaohs. So where did we get the name Ramesses? Well, Ramesses, and we just read it here in this passage that I read a moment ago. Ramesses was the name given to the city where that dynasty reigned. It wasn't called Ramesses originally, but it became called that later on. And in writing to people of a later era, they added the name of the city as it was known at the time. It wasn't known as the city of Ramesses in the time of the Exodus, because that man hadn't even been born for another couple of centuries. If I were to be writing about the new little town that had been set up at the foot of Manhattan to someone who lived prior to the 1660s, I wouldn't call it New York, because it wasn't called New York then. It was called New Amsterdam. Southern Manhattan was first inhabited by the Dutch. It was called New Amsterdam for the first decades of its existence. Only later, when the British took over, New Amsterdam was named after the capital of their home country. Well, when the British took over, well, they couldn't call it New London because there was already a London, but they called it York, New York. But this was later. But if we were writing about that earlier period of time, we would refer to the town by its correct name, especially if it's to those people. But if we're writing to people today, we wouldn't call New York New Amsterdam. Nobody would know what you're talking about. So we call it New York in spite of whatever era we're referring to. Same thing happened with the city where the Israelites lived. They lived in a place called Avaris. Avaris was across the branch of the Nile that they lived on, sort of the satellite city to the royal city, which was to their north across the Pelusiac branch of the Nile River. We know the Israelites lived in Goshen, and Goshen was the favored land of the pharaohs at that point in time. It had the best fields, and they had livestock. The Israelites didn't just make bricks. They also were Sephardic type people. They managed livestock as well. They managed the king's livestock. One of the things they did. And the scriptures say that. I won't go there at the moment. But the city was called Avaris anciently. We could perhaps go to the next slide right now. This is a later pharaoh. And those of you who recognize pharaohs, this fellow was rather unique both in his appearance. He had very effeminate characteristics, but he was also called the heretic pharaoh. This was Akhenaten. Akhenaten was a heretic because he was unusual religiously. He was a monotheist. He worshipped the sun god. He worshipped one god, whereas most in Egypt were polytheists. But Akhenaten moved his capital to Amarna, which is a total ruin today. The place is completely wiped out. The only thing left is some foundations under the sand. But they found this fellow's royal library. And they were clay tablets on which were written. And they found tablets that were written by a descendant of King Saul. After Saul was killed and his son were killed in battle, there was a small part of their family that tried to keep Saul's dynasty alive before David came in and took over as king. It was just a very brief period. But they found tablets written to this fellow in Amarna, pleading for him to come help him stave off the attacks of what are called the Habiru, which is the Egyptian word for the Hebrews, who were surrounding Jerusalem at the time, intending to depose this holdout contingent of Saul's family. Those tablets name David, his father, and his general. Now, what's the coincidence that those names would appear at that period? But what this shows us is this fellow was reigning about the time of King Saul. Now, he was a very ineffective pharaoh. He was basically a do-nothing. And he never responded to this person's request for assistance. But it tells us one thing. It ties him to the time of King Saul, which is very important. Because the next king, which we'll go to next, the very popular Tutankhamun. Tutankhamun was a relative, perhaps a son, I'm not sure, of Akhenaten. This fellow restored the religion back to polytheism. His original name was Tutankhaten. Aten was the name of Akhenaten's god. His name was originally Tutankhaten, and he changed it to Tutankhamun to reflect his worship of the god Amun and its religious system. More likely, the pharaoh of the Exodus was, like I said, Dudemos, which in the Greek is Tutimaos. He was the last of the 13th dynasty, which is not a surprise considering his end in the Red Sea. One thing we need to understand about the dynastic setup in Egypt, the Egyptian chronology is all screwed up. And perhaps it's done deliberately and perhaps not. But the Egyptian chronology does not match the Bible, the biblical chronology. It just does not match it. So as a result, when they go to look for the evidence of the Exodus, they're looking in all the wrong places because they've got the wrong pharaoh identified, particularly Ramesses. Like we said, that was a quarter century later or maybe more. See, what happened in Egypt is sometimes Egypt was one nation. Other times it was two nations, the north and the south. Sometimes they were united. Sometimes they reigned separately. So the numbered dynasties do not occur in succession. Sometimes they overlapped. Sometimes the numbered dynasty of the south would be later than an earlier numbered dynasty of the north. So you can't go by that. It's just something to be aware of. But the Egyptian chronology does not match the Israelite chronology as we find in the books of Kings and Chronicles. So that's part of the reason. Now there is a fellow, and I've got his book, a very interesting read. You can get this in the public library. But his book is called Pharaohs and Kings, A Biblical Quest, written by David M. Roll. David's interest from the youth sailing on the Nile was that he was fascinated with the Egyptian history. But he was unhappy with the fact that Egyptian chronology never matched biblical chronology. So he tried to resolve that. And he's done some interesting, some very serious reconsideration of many of the basic presumptions, the conclusions that have been drawn in Egyptian history. And he's brought them together much closer than ever before. However, the traditionalists don't like the guy for obvious reasons and want to degrade his work. But it's important to realize that the correct chronology, if it were correct, would match the Bible. But where the Israelites lived, like I said, was a town called Avaris on the Pelusiac branch of the Nile, southeast Goshen, and it was close to the Egyptian capital of the time. We could go to the next slide, I think, here. Yes, you can see where Avaris is, where that arrow is. And it's a very logical place for the Israelites to have settled if they'd come down the coast into Egypt. And as you can see, the Nile branches into many, many different branches, but that's this most easterly branch at the point where Avaris is called the Pelusiac branch. And you can see from there how it would be logical for them to go a little bit to the west, is where Sukkoth is, about where that arrow is, and then go south along the shores of the Gulf of Suez. They didn't cross the Red Sea at that point. They crossed somewhere else, and we'll come to that in a short while. But the town of Abaris is interesting because they suspect that the name means the place of the Hebrew man. Now, the Israelites were called Hebrews, and we can read of that in Genesis 39:14. They regarded them as an inferior race, but here in this case, someone of the Hebrew ethnicity is ruling over them, which is profound when you think about it. Some of God's people have been in the highest places ever on earth. Look at Daniel. I mean, that was the leading nation of the time, and Daniel was basically functioning as though he were king. Joseph was in the highest place he could be in the world power in his day. He was effectively ruling over Egypt, certainly its economy. There were various capitals depending on whichever dynasty, but the dynasty of the time of the people going into the Israelites going into Egypt was located in what is now called Ramesses, just across the river from Avaris. We might mention the Exodus began when the Nile was high in the springtime and the moon was full. That's one predictable thing about the lunar calendar. The 15th day of the month, the moon is full. When was the Passover in Egypt? When in respect to what time of year, what time of day? There's a major contingent of people, Bible believers, who believe that the Exodus and the Passover occurred within the same night time. Number of problems with that. One of which, Exodus 12:50, says they were instructed to remain in their houses all night until morning. Another scripture says that they were to burn the remains of their paschal lambs by morning time. And Exodus 12:22 tells us they did what they were commanded. But if the Exodus and the Passover occurred within the same period of darkness, think about what they would have to do. Now, give this some thought. Let's say we were in a situation where we were going on a pilgrimage, and the word came down, forget it, guys, we're not going. Pharaoh says, stay here, we're not going. And then a little after midnight, somebody knocks on your door and says, oh, we're going. Wouldn't you feel that was a cruel joke? I mean, would God play a cruel trick like that on his people? To get up, pack all your stuff, round up all your animals, go get the bones of Joseph out of his tomb, and get out of there before daylight? That's all they had to do. They had to fill their water jars. They had to round up their cattle. How do you round up cattle in the dark? You ever try that? They'll spook. Wouldn't they? No, they need, and they had to spoil the Egyptians. When did they do that? Well, the same day people said, oh, well, they spoiled them long in advance. Problem with that is the ninth plague. The ninth plague was the period of darkness, intense darkness, so intense you could feel it. And the scripture says that when the plague of darkness began, everybody stopped right where they were. And they waited. And 3 days went by. Now, how would you spoil Egyptians during a period of darkness when even a lamp wouldn't throw its light? The only place they had light was in the dwellings of the children of Israel. Not the whole city they were in, just where they were. Everywhere else was intense darkness. You couldn't spoil the Egyptians when they couldn't see a thing. How would they find their treasures and give them to you? How would you find their way to their door? You couldn't see a thing. The period of darkness extended from the midday on the 10th. That's why God had them select their lambs on the 10th. It occurred from the midday on the 10th to the midday on the 13th. That whole period of time before the Exodus was blocked out. Nothing happened. Now that gave the Israelites a fantastic rest before their arduous trip out of Egypt. But they could not have, my point is, they could not have spoiled them before the Passover. The lights came back on midday on the 14th, on the 13th. They prepared for the Passover. They killed their lambs as the sun was going down, as the 14th day was just beginning. And that's when the Passover in Egypt was. This booklet that I got here, this one here, goes into that very thoroughly. They had to use the daylight portion of the day to get their flocks together, to get their people together, to get their houses broken down, to get their tents packed up, ready to go, to get their food stuff ready to go, to fill their water jars, and to go visit the Egyptians, who had just lost their firstborn. And they were of a state of mind that says, we don't get rid of these people, we're going to all be dead. The scripture even says that's what they said. You can see how they would be very generous in giving up their treasures to get rid of those folks. That's when that happened. And then they formed up. Think of this, 3 million people formed up in separate, distinct tribes. And they went out of Egypt orderly, and there's scripture that says they did so in the sight of the Egyptians at the time that they were burying their dead. That tells us that the Exodus was later in the day, because the Egyptians would not have been burying their dead within 2 or 3 hours of the time they died. It would have been during daylight the next day. We have a number of proofs that tell us when the Passover was and when the Exodus was. One of them is very obvious, is in Numbers 33, verse 3. And that couldn't be clearer. It could not be clearer. 33:3. It says, and they departed from Ramesses in the first month, on the 15th day of the first month, on the morrow after the Passover. The children of Israel went out with an high hand in the sight of all of the Egyptians. For the Egyptians buried all their firstborn, which the Lord had smitten among them. Upon their gods also the Lord executed judgments. Very clear, if we want to let it say what it says. The Passover was in the 14th day. The Exodus was in the 15th. Which is how we understand it. But it's important to realize that. The Passover and the Exodus were not in the same night. They were separated by roughly 20 hours. It would have been a logistical impossibility to get out of Egypt in that few hours, let's say from 2 a.m. till sunrise. It's a very brief period of time. How big were how big was the Exodus? We already determined there's at least 2 million, more likely 3, plus the mixed multitude, plus all of their livestock. One estimation has the column of, if the column was 600 feet wide, it would have been 12 miles long. Just in passing, from the time the first people left to the time the last people moved up to where the first people had been, that would have taken from 8, 9, 10 hours. Just for the column to pass at walking speed. Obviously, it would have taken all the next night, not the same night in which the Passover was killed and eaten. I've gotten out of my place a little bit here, but let's go on. We've talked about when they spoiled the Egyptians. We talked about what preparations were required. And let's talk about when was the Exodus. Most of it identify about 1490 BC, perhaps 1491, somewhere in that time frame. It began at dusk, and it extended all during the nighttime. The Egyptians were seen burying their dead. We just read that. The Egyptians saw them leaving. We just read that. And there was a full moon rising, being the 15th day of the month of Abib. And as Numbers 33 just told us, the 15th was the morrow after the Passover. The Iraq War had a very interesting development in it. And we can go to the next frame right now, I think we want. Yes. Let me read this to you. The most amazing thing occurred as a result of the Gulf War. It was a satellite discovery. You see, Big Bird, which is the name of a satellite, photographed more than just buried tanks. I'm reading the wrong side. Saddam Hussein had 1,500 heavy tanks positioned on the border between Iraq and Saudi Arabia. Smart guy. He buried the tanks so that the Americans couldn't find them. He buried them in the sand, leaving only the gun turrets sticking out. These were well camouflaged, effectively making them invisible from the air and any ground surveillance units. By luck, they got discovered. America shifted its Keystone satellite into position over the Iraqi desert. Then the 55-foot-long, 12-ton spy satellite took pictures of the cold desert floor during the twilight hours. And do you know, Big Bird, as it was called, had infrared scanners, which from 155 miles above the Earth could detect a temperature difference of only a half a degree. Problem is, tanks in the sun absorb the heat. The sand around them loses heat faster than the metal of the tanks. So as the sun was going down, they could take these infrared photographs and bing, 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 all of these tanks stood out like fluorescent lights. I'm going to make a long story short here. They also discovered that in the sands of Sinai, there was this trail that showed up. What happened is, with 3 million Israelites and all the cattle and all that, walking this particular route compressed the sand and ground it down to dust. Now, normally on a trail, when that happens underfoot, the dust will be on the surface and it'll blow away. But with so many people, all at once, there was a massive amount of this dust. And in time, it got covered with sand. In time, it hardened up like concrete because of the humidity. If you ever had a bag of concrete in your garage on the floor, you know, after a few months, it begins to solidify, even dry. Well, that's what happened. So there was this bed of sort of like concrete underneath the sands that had this same temperature differential. The normal sand would lose its temperature faster than this hard compressed band. They could see it from this satellite. So they know the route of the Exodus. I won't read all of this, it'll take too much time. But it confirms that there was such an event, which, of course, the scoffers like to say, oh, that never happened. It's too ridiculous. It's too extreme. Too crazy. Nothing like that could ever happen. Well, we have proof. We can see where the land of Goshen was. It's in the extreme eastern part of the Nile Delta. Very fertile, very well watered, very productive land. And we can see where Mount Sinai is. Now, on the left is the Gulf of Suez. Most people think that's where they crossed. Well, no, they didn't. They came out of Goshen. They went a little bit westward to Sukkoth. Then they dropped down along the coast, closer to the water than that. And then they cut across the peninsula, the Sinai Peninsula. And they went down to a place called Nuweiba. Let's go to the next slide. I think that will show a little more. Okay, there's another picture of the same thing, but from higher altitude, a satellite photo. And you can see Nuweiba over here on the Gulf of Aqaba. And it's about 8 to 9 miles across. And incredibly, it's a very deep gulf. But where that line goes across, there is a land bridge under the surface about, at its maximum, about 200 feet deep. And while we're on this slide, we can see also where Mount Sinai is. tradition has Mount Sinai way up there in the middle of the Sinai Peninsula. It's not. It's in Midian. The land of Midian is in southwestern Saudi Arabia. But at that Red Sea crossing, the elevation of the bottom comes up towards the surface. And I think maybe the next slide will give us that profile, if I got the right order. No. All right, let's go with this one. That delta is called Nuweiba. Today it's a resort area. You can see some of the buildings that are there. But it's an area big enough to house for the entire 3 million people to make an encampment. You can see on the right there's the Pihahiroth, which was a location just outside of the Wadi Watir. The Wadi Watir is something like Tibet Canyon over here without the river. It's this narrow profile, very high banks on either side, and that's where Pharaoh realized the land has trapped them in. They were trapped here. To the south, you got mountains that go right straight down into the Gulf. On the north, similar thing. There's a fort down in that lower right corner. But they figured they were trapped. And the Egyptian army pursued them to this location, and that's where they felt trapped and cried out against Moses, thinking it was all over. Well, God put that wall of fire to the west, which was a wall of cloud to the east, to give them light, and the Israelites crossed the Red Sea at that point in time, where the Egyptian army was held in that wadi, and they couldn't outflank what God had put up as an obstacle because they were in this deep canyon. They couldn't have moved the army around. Let's go to the next slide here. That gives us a better picture of the delta and the Wadi Watir straight up. This is now looking east. That's the Wadi Watir that they came through to get out onto this delta, where they waited for the Red Sea crossing to take place, which took place during the nighttime. They crossed the Red Sea all during the night, which gives us a means of determining the length of the column, because the first entered the sea and the last came up out of the sea as dawn was approaching. So we know they got through that 8 miles in about as many hours, and I would have hurried too, I suppose. But it tells us the length of the column. It gives us a physical dimension, and from that we can know the width. And knowing how many people and how many animals, we can get an approximation of how big the Exodus column was. But that's where they were. Now, how big was Pharaoh's army? Most would say, 600 chariots. That's the typical belief. But the scriptures actually say more than that. The scriptures refer to his chariots, his chosen chariots being 600, but also other chariots, all his horsemen, and all his army. And that's in Exodus 14. Josephus says there were 600 chariots, 50,000 horsemen, 200,000 foot soldiers. And that's in Josephus book 2, chapter 15, paragraph 3. The Egyptian army was massive. Just think about it. If there was only 600 chariots and there were 600,000 in Israel's army, that would have been 1,000 to 1. I don't think the chariots would, if there were just them, would have had a chance. If each of the 600,000 in Israel's force picked up 3 rocks, you know, that'd be 3,000 rocks for each chariot. I don't think, you know. Obviously, Pharaoh's army was a lot bigger than that. Where is Mount Sinai? Well, Paul says it's in Arabia. Most people place it in the middle of the Sinai Peninsula, which was Egyptian territory at the time. That would have been in Egypt. It's actually in Arabia, Galatians 4:25. So the mid-Sinai Peninsula location is another point that's really bogus. Where is the land of Midian? Well, it's across the Gulf of Aqaba from this point right here. And if you look at the... We've passed it, but if we were to look at that previous slide, you'll see that it was pretty green down there. It wasn't desert like a lot of the upper parts were. It says that Israel saw dead and floating bodies on and near the east shore, and that's in Exodus 14:30. Let's go to the next slide. Okay, that's the land bridge. Let's stick with that one for a moment. You can see how that the contour is much higher at the crossing point. That bulge on the left is the Nueva Peninsula. See right there, it's much shallower. It's very deep on either side. God knew it was there, but I don't know that anyone else did. But that's where all the wreckage was found from the chariots and the horse bones and the men's bones and the weapons and tools and all of that stuff. After all these years, there's still some remains. It's not that obvious, but if there have been surveys in the area, and they found the wreckage, and some of it we'll see here in a moment. Let's go to the next picture. Okay. On both sides of the crossing point, they found these two columns. One is on one side, one is on the other. The one that was on the west side had been laying in such a way that all the writing on it was weathered off. Fortunately, the one on the Arabian side, the east side, you could still read the lettering. And it were columns erected by King Saul to commemorate the location of the Red Sea crossing. In his day, they knew where it was. King Saul had some mines, and he had some shipping that sailed out of the north end of the Gulf of Aqaba also. So he was active in that area. But this is one of the columns that they've re-erected. I think that one, I'm not sure which side that's on, but that's one of the columns. Let's go to the next slide. Can you see what that is? It's a chariot wheel face down in the sand with part of its axle rotted away, sticking up in the air. And there's more rubble up above. I don't know what that is. That's a chariot wheel. Now, how often did the Egyptians or anybody take their chariots to sea? Especially in this part of the world where there's nobody there to conquer. Nobody ever conquered Midian that we know of. There was too small a nation to matter and too far away to matter. Why would there be all these hundreds of chariots out there in the water? What for? Let's go to the next slide. Can you see what that is? That's a chariot axle sticking straight up in the air, and there's about a quarter of a wheel still left on it, and the rest has fallen away. See that? That's part of the wheel. Now, all over this region, there's an unusual phenomenon. They call it mushroom coral, and it grows nowhere else in the world. But the coral has this stem sticking up in the air, and then this bulb of coral on the top. Well, it's not mushroom coral. It's coral that formed around chariot wreckage. The coral is grown on the wheel, effectively, and that's what preserved a lot of these from decaying completely away. There's many, many more slides, but we'll just settle for those two representatives. Let's go to the next one and see what we've got here. I've kind of forgotten. Okay. That's this book here. Someone told me of it. I think it was my friend Doc Robinson back from, he was Connecticut at the time. He put me onto this. And I picked one up from the library and read it. And once I read it, I had to have a copy. So I went and bought one. It's a very expensive book. But if anyone would like to read it, it's serious reading. Let me tell you, it's full of details. But it's a very interesting. That's that picture of Joseph's statue again. But very, very fascinating. All right, we've talked about the Exodus, but when did the Exodus end? The Exodus ended, and we can read of it in Joshua chapter 5, when they ate the produce of the land outside of Jericho. It tells us that manna ceased the next morning after they ate the produce of the land. It says in Joshua 5:11, that was on the morrow after the Passover. Does that ring a bell? They left Egypt on the morrow after the Passover. So the Exodus began, and the Exodus ended on the 40th anniversary. And we know that the Exodus was on the 430th anniversary of the Abrahamic covenant. Here's the fun part that brings this thing full circle. Before Jericho fell, Joshua was out roaming about early in the morning, and he came upon an angel that said, "Take off your shoes. This is where you stand is holy ground." Now, the Abrahamic covenant was made in the vicinity of the Dead Sea, where Abraham's forces had defeated the kings who had invaded the area and taken his nephew, Lot, and the people of the area, taken them captive. Abraham's forces chased them down, defeated those kings, and brought back the spoils. It was about that point in time when the Abrahamic covenant was made. Now, this is in the vicinity of Jericho. Was Joshua standing at the very location where the Abrahamic covenant was made? Interesting thought. But we know the time was the same. Whether the place was the same, we could leave that as a matter of speculation. But it's all a very fascinating story. God gives us a lot of information, and we've probably only looked at a small fraction of it. But we should know when the Passover was, when the Exodus was. And the Exodus was called, or the Exodus occurred on what was called the night to be much observed. That is, as I explained a week ago, that is the most ancient observance in all the world. It goes back clear to about a century or less after the time that Noah died. A very ancient observance, and we still understand it for what it means. But it was Israel's release from physical bondage, but it's typical of our release from spiritual bondage in this Egypt in which we live. Sorry I've gone a little long, but I hope it was interesting enough to be worth the time.